Welcome to Hidden Layers, where we explore the people and the technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green. We're back today with another episode of Decoded, where we take a look at recent developments in the AI industry. And as usual, we've got a lot to discuss today. To help me pick through this, I'm joined by two of my fantastic Kung Fu AI colleagues, our VP of Engineering, Michael Wharton, and Director of Engineering, Reed Koch. Welcome, guys.
Glad to be here.
Very happy to be back.
All right, so let's just jump in. I'm going to kick things off. I want to talk about first the big breakup of the OpenAI superalignment team. It was really interesting. I had my interview with Scott Aronson literally 2 weeks ago. We're sitting there, we're talking about his work and his collaboration with Ilya Sutskever, co-founder, former board member, chief scientist at OpenAI, and Jan Laike. And we spend the whole conversation talking about alignment, and we wrap the conversation, and like 2 hours later, we hear the news that they had both resigned. So this is, I think, not only interesting, but really important for a bunch of reasons. One is, you know, Jan's group, they kind of pioneered this use of reinforcement learning with human feedback on InstructGPT. And, you know, candidly, I kind of would have doubted it would work remotely as well as it does. It's phenomenal. And I think that you can point to that technique for being a large part of the reason that ChatGPT 4 is especially useful to humans, right? It's not just focused on being a good token generator or sentence completer. It's just really good at being useful to humans. And a lot of that's because of the work done in that reinforcement learning with human feedback. Ilya has not said much since he departed. Jan has. And so I want to couple things here because I think they're kind of important. So Jan said, you know, he'd been having disagreements with the OpenAI leadership for some time about the company's priority, and they finally reached a breaking point a couple weeks ago. I'm going to quote here. He says, "I believe much more of our bandwidth should be spent getting ready for the next generation of models on security, monitoring, preparedness, safety, adversarial robustness, super alignment, confidentiality, societal impact, and related topics. These problems are quite hard to get right, and I'm concerned we aren't on a trajectory to get there." He also has further said that, you know, he thinks AGI, artificial general intelligence, is much closer than a lot of people think. And then, you know, when I was talking to Scott, we talked about the promise that OpenAI made publicly last year to set aside 20% of their compute for this alignment of, you know, super intelligent systems. And again, Jan goes on to say that over the past few months, my team has been sailing against the wind. Sometimes we were struggling for compute, and it was getting harder and harder to get the crucial research done. So he doesn't necessarily say if they were or weren't getting the 20%. I suppose it's possible.
Say that sounds counter to what they were saying. Yeah,
it's possible that they were getting the 20, but that's not enough. And you know, it goes saying that OpenAI has a massive computational infrastructure. But just to wrap up on this, a couple of things. The reason I think this is so important is not only that OpenAI is doing some of the most important work in AI in the entire world, but they're sort of on the bleeding edge of the most powerful models, and they were leading the effort, at least optically, on super intelligence alignment. And the final thing I want to point in here is that Jan says, you know, to all OpenAI employees, I want to say, learn to feel the AGI. And that is apparently something that Ilya in particular was saying frequently over the last couple of years. And the sentiment there is that AGI is closer than people realize. You need to feel it, because if you don't feel it, you won't take it seriously enough. And this work around super alignment is incredibly important. Jan is now at Anthropic, which I think, you know, we all agree is probably a better fit for him there. They're taking alignment much, much more seriously. But this, again, you know, like we were talking about before we started recording, this is not just some minor thing that's going to affect a product timeline. We're talking about super intelligence alignments. You know, how are we going to keep AI systems that would be as intelligent or even more intelligent than humans aligned with our, you know, ethics and values? All right. So, Michael, I'm going to turn it over to you. What's happened recently in AI that caught your attention?
Yeah, a lot, honestly. There's a whole lot going on, but if I had to narrow it down to one, I think I've been following around this idea of these Kolmogorov Arnold networks. I'm sure a lot of folks that are listening have probably at least seen some chatter on those, at least in the research community,
right,
at minimum. But I think these are really interesting because they are one of very few innovations that have come after the multilayer perceptron, the dense network that we're all really familiar with. And anytime there's something that fundamentally improves or at least changes or gives us some sort of notion that there's another way to do it, it's worth paying attention to, I think. And apparently they're not necessarily new. I heard that there was, I think it was around 2002, that there was something like them that had been mentioned in the literature.
Well, I feel like nothing's new, right?
Yeah,
yeah, that's true.
Something's always been tried before.
Yeah, oh, and the original author's always going to raise their hand and be like, oh, no, I thought this first. Yeah.
Exactly.
But they did do a lot of comprehensive analysis on at least toy examples in this paper. And the way they work is essentially, instead of having completely densely connected linear layers like we're used to with these multilayer perceptrons, is they actually have these, actually I should back up, multilayer perceptrons are based on this idea of the universal approximation theorem. These, on the other hand, are based on the Kolmogorov-Arnold, this theorem that basically says that any multivariate function that is continuous can be represented as a combination or summation of univariate functions.
Right.
So instead of having a linear combination of all these inputs, you sort of silo them off in their little, you know, receptive fields in this network. And then what I think was pretty clever is they throw them through these splines, these activations that are, instead of being just stuck on nodes, they're trainable parameters.
Right.
Like it's literally tuning the control points of these
splines. Right. It's literally the inverse. The weights are not weights anymore. They're fixed and the functions are tunable.
Yeah. It's really cool. And actually, there's some really great GIFs and visuals that you can go check out online if you go search around for it. But to cut to the chase, there are some interesting properties that I think are just really interesting to note. One of them is that the authors claim that these are really parameter efficient, up to and including the point that they might be like couple orders of magnitude more parameter efficient than MLPs in some cases. So that might have a lot of implications for mobile applications or places where compute's really constrained.
Yeah. And is that, because I know that they can also sort of reduce the number of parameters as they train. Is that initial parameter efficient, or is that we started with the same and we ended up with fewer, therefore it's more efficient?
Yeah, actually, there is some criticism in the research community right now about the authors of this paper might not have necessarily put as much work into not only training these MLPs, but pruning them back. So it could be that they're taking advantage of the fact that it's really easy to prune these things, but perhaps the MLPs that they have are already a little bit over capacity and would have been fine if they did a similar pruning exercise.
Well, and my mind immediately goes to the lottery hypothesis, right? That idea that there's already exactly. The Frankel paper, where there's already some subset within this randomly initialized NLP that will solve the problem. You just have to pair it back to find it. So we know, I think we know there are already vastly over parameterized just generally, but that's not that useful in practice because then you have to print them back.
Yeah. Yeah. And presumably it's very easy to do that. And it's just kind of a logical consequence of how these things end up being trained.
Okay.
But just to cut to the chase on a few others, they're much more interpretable, which I think is very interesting. You get a really nice kind of closed form symbolic expression of what your outputs are supposed to be very easily. There's also this idea of grid extension where, since they're using splines, they have this notion of slight changes in a local neighborhood don't necessarily dramatically impact the rest of this thing, like you would with polynomials or honestly with MLPs, you have this problem. So you can have this tune really local neighborhoods. And then if it turns out that you're under capacity, it's obvious. And you can, much like progressive growing GANs, I remember that paper from years ago, similar idea, you train up to the point where you have an asymptote in performance. And then you just add granularity and continue training, which is, you can't really do that, at least to my knowledge, with MLPs, because there's so much shared representation across all of the network.
Exactly.
And then you just, this one, you just kind of add grids and details and stop whenever you get to the capacity you need. But I know you guys are really familiar with it as well. I'm curious what your thoughts are. You got any hot takes or ideas?
So I was doing some more of like beginner style reading on this stuff. And one of the things that the resource I was looking at was really talking up with, you hinted at it for a second, that you get these kind of like closed form equations for how to get to an output from an input. And that's really appealing for like mobile cases where, you know, you're wanting to sort of minimize or even do on-device inference, or anything like, you know, some kind of like advertising or financial application where you need like, you know, 10 millisecond response time. Mm-hmm. I think all of us have done projects where we couldn't use state-of-the-art machine learning because of the latency requirements of the system. And everything I was reading was indicating that these types of networks take a lot longer to train, but then you kind of recoup that on inference and you can...
Yeah, like an order of magnitude at least.
At least, yeah. Probably considerably more. I think that's really interesting because it kind of seems like they, like you said, they have considerably different strengths and might be, at least in the short term, really useful in very different areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that idea of paying maybe a bigger price up front for training to save it on inference, I mean, that's going to be more and more important over time as you take some model and then that model may be serving millions of inference requests, you know, per hour, right? I did a little bit of digging into this. I was wondering, why are they using splines? And I found out it's actually for some really solid reasons. Number one, splines are both smooth and continuous on first and second order derivatives. So right there, that's something.
Yeah.
They are also, like you said, Michael, they've got much better local control. Small adjustments result in small changes. And they're also numerically more stable. So it seems like there are lots of really good reasons behind that choice as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still totally in its infancy, and who knows how these things are, what their quirks are. But I'm excited to follow the research and see what comes out of it.
Yeah, me too.
Definitely.
Well, Reed, what you got?
So unsurprisingly, I'm all about evaluation. This is always the thing coming from NLP. It's very hard to tell whether words are good or not, or, you know, they ain't, whatever you want. I've kind of re-excavated something recently that had slipped past me initially. So about a year ago, there was a paper when GPT was sort of, GPT-4 specifically was really fresh. They had to take the bar. They had to take the Illinois State Uniform Bar Exam. And they reported that they, being a group, Stanford plus another research group, I believe their name was Codex, they together kind of came up with this problem formulation of let's have it take the bar. And they reported that it scored in the 90th percentile overall for all the test takers that February. Super, super impressive, right? Like, this is a much more interesting way to evaluate language systems than Perplexity, which I just generally don't believe in as much as a lot of other people do, because I don't think the exact words really matter all that much.
Right.
Passing the bar, that seems a lot less disputable, I thought. However, about just a few months ago, about a year later, this MIT paper came out that sort of called into question some of the evaluation methodologies from this bar study. And I've read some of these down because I definitely don't want to misrepresent them. But what they found was, first of all, the original study took the bar in February. And according to the follow-up paper, February is when people take it who failed it in July. And generally, they just do much worse. Their scores are just, on average, much lower than the maybe more standard
set
of test
takers.
Oh, so you mean
the set they were comparing
the results? Yes, the humans taking it in February tend to do it because they struggled in July. And once you start struggling once, apparently you kind of continue to struggle generally. I've also never taken the bar, so taking some of these things on faith. So that's one interesting thing already, right? It's like 90% in a small pond maybe is one way to think about it. Mm-hmm. On top of that, the MIT paper, the second paper, compared it to a set of test takers from a test in July, and the numbers are considerably worse. So, right, 90th percentile overall is the initial headline that is really exciting. If you compare it to July test takers, it drops down to 69th percentile and 48th percentile on writing, because there's like a kind of a essay portion separate, sort of semi like the SAT in that way. If you compare it only to first time test takers from the July exam, it's in the 62nd percentile overall, 42nd in writing. And if you compare it only to people who passed, it's in the 48th percentile and the 15th percentile in writing. And this really struck me because there's no shortage of headlines about all the incredible things that GPT is doing. And it's doing a lot of incredible things. I'm not trying to detract from, I'm trying a little, but not too much to detract from that. But I'm really curious to hear what y'all think is the best comparison point of that whole set, or the most valid, or the most real, like, you know, yeah, I guess it's, I'll go with valid.
You mean like, of the results, which one should they've used?
Yeah. Or which one maybe, regardless of what they should have done or not as researchers, like which one's the most meaningful as someone, you know, we're much more on the side of employing these things and using them than we are in developing.
Well, I mean, the problem right at the get-go is what you've alluded to at the beginning, Reid, which is it's so difficult to evaluate these systems, right? Perplexity used to be a relatively good measure, and now that we're way beyond that, it's getting harder and harder to even know how to judge these systems. So here's a question before I answer: like on the bar, is how are they evaluating it? Do you know? Is it a human looking at the results and making a determination?
That's a great question. I don't know for sure. I would have assumed that it was, but there is a point in the MIT paper where they also mention other methodological concerns with how the essay score was calculated in the original paper. Mm. So that would suggest that maybe it's not going through the exact normal standard.
Yeah, channel. That's a pretty subjective essay as well, right? Like it's...
I've heard the whole test level is objective from what I've heard of, like, okay. There's... but I guess not so subjective that it can't be scored.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's really hard. It's really actually kind of funny. You don't know this, but this segues perfectly into my next topic, okay, which is around data sets. So I'm kind of dodging answering your question, and then I want to tee this up and we'll come back to it. Okay. So I think it was just yesterday, it might have been 2 days ago, that the FineWeb EDU data set was released. So there is a data set called the FineWeb. It's 15 trillion tokens. It's a subset of the Common Crawl, but it was clean. It was cleansed and deduped in English web data to be used specifically for large language model training. The brand new FineWeb EDU data set is a filtered version of that. And what's really interesting, there's many things interesting about it. One, it was filtered by Llama 3. The 70 billion parameter model. So this just came out, you know, within the last 60 days. They used Llama 3 to judge the content and filter that 15 trillion tokens down to 1.3 trillion tokens. And they focused mostly on high quality educational content. And this is interesting for a bunch of reasons. One is there's increasing evidence that higher quality data is disproportionately valuable. You know, when you're training on the Common Crawl, you've got contradictory information. You've got a lot of noise basically in the signal. Andre Kabathi, he was really excited about it. He actually was tweeting about this just yesterday. His open source project, LLM.c, which is a pure C sort of CUDA implementation of the GPT-2.3 blend architecture, he wrote that it was already performing better than the GPT counterparts, even though it was trained on about an order of magnitude, more than an order of magnitude, fewer tokens. And his theory is that just the training set data was better. So he's going to look at this. But the other thing that's really interesting is, as we mentioned on the last episode of Decoded, the Phi-3 model for Microsoft, mm-hmm. which was released in May, I believe, of 24, their claim to fame was that it was trained on a much, much smaller data set with many, many fewer parameters. And they have this this idea that textbooks are all you need, right? The idea that high quality training data is the real differentiator there. And I think we're now starting to see really strong third-party empirical evidence that that's the case. So I'm really excited about this. So to tie it back into your question, Reid, with these higher quality data sets, being filtered by LLMs is maybe that it, where we're going to have like turtles all the way down, where we'll have the LLMs custom trained to evaluate the output of these other LLMs, and we'll kind of bootstrap and they'll stand on each other's shoulders.
It sounds effective, but expensive.
Yeah.
I have a very, very alternate idea, which is think about what you're doing and pick something matched to that.
Completely agree.
To show my hand a little on what I think about the bar results. But I am going to hold you to answering the question.
All right. So I...
So we've got February, July 1st timers, and people who passed.
Well, how about just taking the blended average?
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. But then where do you... You could come up with more categories.
Yeah.
Why is it those four specifically?
Yeah. Michael, what do you think?
Just extending... I mean, I had the exact same thought that you had, Reed, where I think that really it does depend on the downstream use case. Because if you're talking about doing some paralegal work that's really monotonous, setting a bar to exactly what they did, or I guess leaving it at the initial performance metric that they had in the original headline, you know, something like that's probably fine. I think rank ordered, it seems clear that there's at least some sort of obvious one's better than the other in terms of general performance on the bar. But I think that the big thing that comes to mind here is how important I think it is to have intellectual honesty when you're reporting on evaluation metrics, because not everyone's going to know a perfect assessment of their model whenever they release it out there. But there are certainly ways to either obfuscate the results, mm-hmm. cherry pick, you know, focus on one particular side of it that seems a lot more interesting for the clickbait. But I feel like I see this kind of push and pull between the research community, who's really focused on intellectual honesty. The second you start to embellish something, you have a mob of people that get on to you and they're like, well, hold on, let's be really honest and safe here. And then you also have popular media where the exact opposite is happening. Everything's sensational. And
right. And not to mention companies that might have a financial rationale for exaggerating.
It sort of brings me all the way back to the alignment question that we started with, or the news, I guess. But I have this sort of maybe hot take, maybe lukewarm take. I don't know how popular it is, but I view the product, the capabilities, that's exactly the difference, actually. The capabilities coming out of OpenAI much more as exactly that than as products or solutions, as someone who really is focused on the system can look like whatever it needs to look like. Let's make sure it really helps you. It's hard for me to think about how you solve alignment in a general case without actually knowing what it's going to be used for, because it's so easy to come up with use cases where the definition of alignment is contradicting itself, right?
Right.
That's also how I feel about this, the bar stuff, consequently. It's kind of, well, yeah, it depends. Are you doing the super monotonous paralegal work, or are you trying to defend yourself in court and prep using GPT? In that case, you might want the people who passed. So yeah,
probably, yeah.
You know, yeah, but that's to me, it's a question of alignment. And yeah, I suppose I'm a little more in the research camp in terms of just saying 90% and throwing a thumbs up does feel a little bit like you're shortchanging the people who are actually going to use it. Yeah. Disingenuous.
Right.
Sensationalism still feels pretty good though.
Yeah. Hey,
90 is a great number.
Yeah. It's big. It's bigger than 69.
And it's not 100. So it looks good.
Yeah.
Michael, what's your next topic?
My next topic, I was going to talk a little bit about this whole, I noticed that The Atlantic, and this, I guess this was just last month, but a week or two ago, it wasn't that long ago, there was an article that came out from the editor-in-chief of The Information, who I'm sure a lot of us in the tech world have heard about. She wrote this piece about how people in the publishing industry should not get in bed with the tech industry. In the past, it hasn't worked out. You know, she referenced a lot of stuff like Google News and situations where, from a business side, the publishers don't really win out at the end of the day. They're kind of hamstrung into deals that they don't really stand to gain a lot from, versus just sticking to their core traditional values and high quality journalism. Mm-hmm. Her argument was that they should do exactly that, resist the urge to partner with all these big tech companies. And here OpenAI is just gobbling up all these publishing companies. And then 5 days later, there's this big headline that was like, Atlantic now partnered with OpenAI. It's like, oh my God, that's either one hand's not talking to the other, or there's some internal strife. And, you know, they just kind of push that out as kind of a, you know.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was interesting. The really interesting thing to think about, though, I think, is that, you know, we see every day, it seems like OpenAI has a new news company that they're partnering with. And I think they benefit in a couple ways, at least. You know, one is they get high quality training data, and they get to skirt around this copyright issue that we keep hearing about. And although the legal side is not necessarily totally settled, as I understand it, they're de-risking the issue that there'll be blowback, and they can still have high quality training data. And then the other side is that they have real time access to high quality, reputable resources, unlike, you know, social media in the case where it's pretty unconstrained.
Mm-hmm.
And from that standpoint, considering we're in an election year, having them have access, direct access to high quality content where someone who's trying to generate political opinions, you know, it's risky. If those are not right, they're hallucinations, and then people end up making assumptions that are untrue. That's clearly a problem, because there's this layer of abstraction between the actual news and the interface that the users are working in. But on the other hand, if people have really rapid access to long form content with nuanced opinions that it's expressing, I could see it maybe being a good thing too. I'm curious what y'all think.
I need to chew on that for a second.
Yeah, I've got very mixed emotions about it, because I think the thing that I'm probably least happy with some of the big AI companies is this idea that, hey, now that I've used all of your data to train my model, you can't use the output of my model in any way for downstream tasks, mm-hmm. downstream modeling or anything like that. It seems just, you know, absolutely misguided and unfair, you know, sort of mm-hmm. deeply unfair. I don't really know. I mean, I don't think any of us know exactly how things are going to play out here. But I think that that there's a sense of urgency that we weren't even seeing a year ago. And the rumors are, you mm-hmm. know, that Apple is about to announce, you know, next week that they've done some type of partnership with OpenAI. And to me, that really says a lot if, you know, if what is at the time right now, the second largest company in the world and, you know, one of the leading tech companies in the world is now also going to be partnering with OpenAI along with Microsoft, the largest company in the world, leading tech company in the world. It really says, I think, volumes about the unique position that OpenAI is in and sort of the head start that they have.
Yeah. It's very interesting. You know, we've seen a number of companies announce a big partnership with OpenAI and then realize they didn't really get out of it what they were hoping to. We've seen companies rush to release something to compete with OpenAI and flub it and have some very serious consequences.
You wouldn't happen to be talking about Google putting generative AI results in their search?
Actually, I wasn't. I was talking about a different Google snafu.
Oh, really?
Which just one? The previous one where they had the hallucination in the reveal trailer for... I don't think it was actually Gemini. I think it was a different name powered by Gemini, the earlier version.
Yeah.
And then they took
maybe
that
Bard or something.
Yeah, the Bard release video. That is what it was.
That's what it was.
No, there's also that, though.
Yeah, the one where somebody recently searched and showed that it was some, it pulled some data from Reddit about putting glue on your pizza or something like that, right?
Yeah, it was a recipe.
Yeah.
That it,
yeah.
It was like, it was literally non-toxic glue was one of the ingredients listed. And everything else looked great, but it's like, huh?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. It's very hard to tell what is moving too fast and what is risking falling behind and what's real and what's not. I emotionally don't love the idea of news getting wrapped up in that very directly.
It feels very scary, yeah.
Agreed.
But at the same time, you know, the models are already there. Hypothetically, adding this will make them better. That should be good, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I guess I don't really know what to make of it. It seems like potentially very good, potentially very scary.
Guaranteed to be exciting.
Yeah.
Either way.
Potentially very good, potentially very scary. I think you just described all of AI right now as removing the cord,
sure.
You know? Reed, do you have another topic you want to cover?
Actually, a shockingly good segue. I was going to ask y'all, you know, there's a lot of buzz about AGI. How fast could that happen? There's a lot of buzz about Gen AI displacing skilled workers. And I'm going to say experts, really, because that's sort of what I mean. I am curious to what degree y'all think expert roles are at risk for being replaced.
Michael?
I think usually when people talk about this, they refer to it as what I would say is kind of a false dichotomy. It's either you don't have expert work replacing humans, or all human labor just goes out the window and it disappears. And I think it's clear that if people try to rush to just completely cutting humans out of the loop, there are countless examples in industry where that kind of falls on its head. Not to mention the cultural backlash you get whenever people, I mean, it doesn't feel good to have your job just taken away overnight. I wouldn't like that. Most people wouldn't like that. You work hard to get your job. I think we're going to see a lot more success and adoption if there's a little bit more of a smooth continuum toward that. I think people could probably agree in the long term, having a world where you can kind of do whatever you want and a lot of the world's just automated in a great way. It sounds kind of utopian, maybe a little scary in certain contexts. But I think that the more we can shift the conversation a little bit toward exactly how human augmenting approaches are going to shape the world, I think that's a little bit more productive and realistic than this, you know, kind of the sci-fi, you know, everyone's jobs are gone overnight.
Right.
Thing.
Right.
I totally
agree. And it's in, you know, at Kung Fu AI, this is something we like steadily counsel all of our clients to take the perspective of, don't go build AI systems just to take people's jobs. Go build these systems to make their jobs more efficient or faster or easier. Go empower people, this idea of human augmentation. I'm much, much more of a fan of that. Now, to your point about, you know, down the line, wouldn't it be amazing if we had just global access to the greatest, you know, medical advice or legal advice or whatever it may be. I think that is really, really attractive. But to your point, Reed, you know, the specifics matter, right? The specific use case matters. If you're looking for something like, you know, you have just something minor that you want to get evaluated, that is much, much more, I think, amenable in the short term to some type of expert advice, AI expert advice, versus if you're talking about something lethal, you know, like cancer diagnosis or something like that. So it's still early days. I think things are moving so quickly, it's difficult to see how it's going to play out. But I'll add one more thing, which is I do think that it's interesting that AI systems are increasingly sort of threatening professional jobs in a way that's never been true before, right? Throughout history, throughout the Industrial Revolution and the Information Revolution, it's typically been the lower paid jobs that bore the brunt of that disruption, right? And the rest of the professional class just kind of surfed on top. And I think that that's going to be different this time in ways that I don't think any of us fully understand yet.
Yeah. With the exception maybe of like artists who are somehow in both of those cases,
right.
Or all three, but
yeah.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this a lot, and I have kind of two maybe points of comparison, because I never did look up the difference between a metaphor and an analogy after we talked about that. One of them is, you know, you think about the Industrial Revolution, you think about the job displacement that came from later factory automation. And, this is not an area that I'm an expert in, but I, you know, I've been thinking about a lot how, you know, adding like an arm that does something that a person or three, five people used to do, that's a case where you have this incredibly well-defined problem. You know exactly what needs to happen. It's exactly the same every single time, and you can tell exactly if it worked or not. You can, you know, it's your problems then turn into like fairly well-defined maintenance issues, and maybe like cooling or power or something along those lines. And, you know, I think that a lot of other work isn't like that to that degree. And I think that that presents a lot of very meaningful challenges that make this a very, very different question from, oh, yeah, the machines shut up and I don't have a job anymore. Mm-hmm. Not to make light of that at all. So, and the other side that I've been thinking about is like how people talk about websites and latency and performance requirements. So a few years ago, someone introduced me to this concept of P99 latency, which is this idea that, you know, when you go, when you hit a website, when you make a request, it's not always going to be able to react at exactly the same speed. There's going to be sort of this distribution of how often was it quite fast? How often did it lag a little bit? Most of the time, it's somewhere in the middle. However, if you just look at that sort of distribution, it's pretty easy to say like, oh yeah, like, you know, 90% of the time, things are great. But then when you actually go look at the mechanics of making a request to a website, you're not actually, as a user, only making one single request. You're probably spawning 10 or 15 or more, depending on how the website is set up. So you actually encounter that 99th percentile, the worst case outcome, a whole lot more often than just looking at a distribution would suggest.
Right.
You know, hypothetically, if you spawned 100 requests every time you try to load a page, you'd be looking at the worst case a lot of the time.
Yep.
And so I think also there's an aspect of that when you think about the full complete automation is, you know, we're not sitting doing one thing all the time. And, you know, me doing it once here and you doing it once there is not perfectly equivalent. It's a lot more complicated. And even if failure rates 99% of the time are looking actually very healthy, that probably means what, like 20 failures a day for an individual or something like that?
Right.
Stacks up.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a very important difference between on paper by the numbers what success sort of looks like and this sort of like real world grounded experience of what that actually means for outcomes.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit earlier this week. This idea that if you have an AI system and it's doing some job that is, you know, potentially dangerous, whether it's diagnosing cancer or, you know, driving an automobile autonomously. It's not going to be okay for it to be as good as humans. It's going to have to be much, much, much better because I think it's just a normal for human perceptions to feel like when a system like that made a mistake, to think of the counterfactual of, well, you know, human probably would have gotten that right. And so I think we're going to have much, 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 much lower failure rates before we see any type of autonomous systems out there in the real world, or we have, you know, diagnosis systems, like I said, around, you know, lethal diseases become predominant.
You know, I think that's actually a really interesting point because there's inevitably going to be at least some sort of cultural backlash and issues with adoption, even if something's really performant. But I think that completely falls away once you do have something like a cancer prediction system or what have you, where once it reaches that really high performance threshold, it turns into negligence not to use it.
Right.
I mean, you have people that are going to be losing their lives more often than they would be otherwise. And once it reaches that threshold, then absolutely,
it's everything flips.
A foregone it conclusion. You have to use it.
That's a really good point.
I also think it's you know, the reaction, the adoption, it's wildly different if you have an error profile that is similar to a human's or if you have a system that can do things a human never could and also completely flubs other stuff that anyone with two eyes would be able to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have one more topic I want to cover. I'm going to do this one pretty quickly. Just a couple days ago, there was a Mamba 2 paper that came out, and the paper's not actually called Mamba 2. It's actually called Transformers or SSMs or Structured Space State Space Models. It's by Tree Dao and Albert Gu. You both know I was a pretty big fan of the original Mamba paper that came out in, I think it was December of 2023. A couple of interesting points here I want to mention. One is they do some really deep theoretical framework uncovering that the transformer architecture with, you know, the self-attention mechanism actually can be viewed as a form of the structured state space model approach that was behind the Mamba paper. And that there's this sort of structured space duality. They, you know, we talked about this before. It can have both a continuous, a discrete, and sort of recurrent aspects to it. And what I really like about this is they showed the commonalities of it. And it looks like, you know, as we've talked about, it's the quadratic nature of transformers, that idea that as the input context grows, the amount of computation goes up, not linearly, but it gets squared. This doesn't have that problem. The sort of structure state space approach. And this is really important. Some people miss this. It's not about being able to put in a text prompts of a million words so you can understand, you know, a legal briefing necessarily, and you get to a million contexts and you're fine. You have to think about it from like a much larger perspective. Think genomics, right? Where there are 3 billion nucleotides in each human's DNA. And if you were going to try to do something like look at 5 generations of genomic information as the context window for one of these models, it's completely impractical at this point. And it's one of the reasons I'm really, really excited about this. And I think fundamentally their paper, which I'm going to link to in the show notes here, they've put together a website in addition to the paper that does a really great job of kind of walking through the details of this. But I think it's really interesting that they've revealed this sort of deep underlying connection between transformers and structured state space models.
That's actually really interesting as well to think about from, my background is a lot in aligned with mechanical engineering, and I kind of had a little bit of a career shift, but thinking about these large assemblies that have a lot of sensor data associated with them, a car is a great example. I could see this being really interesting in cases like that, where you have this really high frequency time series signal coming from a ton of different sensors, and historically making inferences across long time periods is computationally expensive or challenging. But I could see this kind of...
That's a perfect example. I hadn't even thought about that one. Yeah, like ginormous time series situations. Love it.
To draw a very old historical reference here, there was a moment when WordDevec was getting big. Just gotten big in like 2014. And this paper came out, if I'm remembering everything correctly, because this is AI ancient history, or, nigh ancient, I guess, where people were saying, well, actually, it turns out that WordDevec is basically just, it's like mathematically equivalent to LDA as long as you hold a few parameters static, or, fix a few things. It sure didn't hold back WordDevec. But it's just interesting that, I think, and I'm sure there are many, many other cases of, there's a new thing. Maybe we came at it a new direction. It turns out actually it is largely the same, but that doesn't diminish what's going on whatsoever.
We were talking about, everything's been tried before, state space models. This goes back to the 50s. So it's everything old is new again. All right, Michael Reed, thank you so much for joining me today. I know we had a lot more to discuss, but we ran out of time. I really appreciate it. We'll do another one of these in about a month.
That's I'm sure there'll be 50 new things. So
you know it.
It'll be a pleasure.
You know it. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.